Hey, you guys, it's Daisha. This is my interview with violist Kim Kashkashian, wherein you're going to learn a number of things. Number one, you're going to learn what makes box music span time. It just keeps going and going like the Energizer Bunny across the centuries. But why? Kim explains. Number two, you're going to learn why it is that classical musicians play the same music over and over again. And number three, you're going to learn why it was more than okay for Kim to have played the Bach cello suites on her viola, and lots of other stuff. This was one of those conversations where I was like, I never thought of it like that before. And I hadn't had anything but coffee to drink, remarkably. But when you listen, I hope that you will appreciate my tact in getting through almost an entire episode without bringing up the Kardashians, and that you will get so much out of the conversation that you are moved to subscribe to, rate, and review the show. Every time one of you does that, a violist meme gets its wings. And now, a word from our sponsor. This episode of the Classical Classroom Podcast is sponsored by Maestro Classics. Visit maestroclassics.com and listen to their recording of The Carnival of the Animals by composer Camille Saint-Saëns, featuring the London Philharmonic Orchestra with pianist Dana Kwong and Wendy Chin. This Carnival of the Animals CD and MP3 also includes a colorfully illustrated booklet with the complete Ogden Nash verses, illustrated by Anne Wilsdorf, available at maestroclassics.com, Amazon, and on iTunes. All right, and now the show. Bon app a listen. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
It's how to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical
voice. I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is Grammy Award-winning violist Kim Kashkashian. She teaches viola and chamber music at the New England Conservatory, and her album Six Suites for Viola Solo will be coming out really soon. So, Kim, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you, Daisha. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, okay, before we dive into Bach, I want to know what makes you so passionate about the viola, which you clearly are. It's, you know, it's the classical music instrument that people make the most jokes about on the internet. So what makes you love it so much?
If you were to think about how a chorus is set up, with sopranos and altos and tenors and baritones and basses, then you would have the viola corresponding to the alto voice. The violin is the soprano voice, and the cello is the tenor voice. So I love being right in the middle, and I love being able to relate to either downwards to the tenors or upwards to the sopranos. And I love the fact that the alto voice is, in a way, the most human of all of them. So that's why. Yeah.
What made you start playing the viola to begin with? Like, did you start on a different instrument? Because it's a pretty unique thing. I don't speak to a lot of violists. So, yeah, how did you come to it?
Well, Daisha, there are more and more young people who begin on the viola. I began playing the violin at the age of 9 because I was offered the chance to take instrumental music lessons in the public school where I was attending. And there was a violin in the family that a cousin of mine had stopped playing. So that was a practical question at first. And as soon as possible, I moved to the viola because I preferred the alto voice. So I just identified.
You like the sound. Like even as a kid, you just thought that sound, you just liked that particular
sound. Yes, I did, even as a kid. And I believe that all children will identify. If they can hear all the instruments in an orchestra, they're going to jump up and down at some of them and not at others. And those are, right. that's their identity, vocal identity. Yeah.
I love the idea that you're so attracted to the instrument just because of its sort of position, where you can sort of pivot in either direction and you know, be, I guess, in conversation with, you know, either end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. As a classical music newbie, you know, I'm a person who comes from a rock and pop background, and I'm really still trying to wrap my head around the idea of a multitude of musicians playing one composer's works, and often the same works, over and over again. And it's not a criticism at all. It's just a difference that I've noticed. Like, I can't imagine a rock album, like a Sonic Youth album or something like that, being recorded by multiple people over and over again. But it's this totally normal thing in classical music. And can you tell me why that is?
You're bringing up a very, very, very important question. And I'm going to answer it a little bit indirectly.
Okay.
But it might help. I hope it helps.
Yeah.
When people visit a museum, mm-hmm. they're going back over and over again to see certain of the famous classic works of art that were,
yeah.
let's say, composed, painted centuries ago.
Uh-huh.
And their reaction to those pieces and their interaction with those pieces of art remain very personal and very much embedded in the environment and situation in which they live today. And yet they are referencing something that is so universal, so personal, and yet so universal.
Mm-hmm.
The Mona Lisa, it's, you know, let's give the
most
obvious example. Okay, droves of people want to see that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And many people will go back time after time after time, mm-hmm. or stand there and stare at it for an hour or two.
Yeah.
And they're always in dialogue with that piece of art, and they're always getting something more out of it or different out of it in response to where they stand in their world at that moment. And I would have to say it's the same with the great composers. I would compare them to a great work of literature or a great work of art, which can be visited and learned from.
I love that.
Yeah?
Yeah, I really like that idea, because it makes it, like, I can understand that. Like, there's something iconic, something archetypical.
Yes.
That's in there that people are identifying with.
Yes.
From wherever they're coming.
Exactly right.
Saying? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think there are...
I've never thought about it like that.
Well, it's because, you know, we have a text. The music is written down.
Yeah.
It's a written architecture which we bring to life sonically, right? But the architecture and the text exist just like a painting does.
I've always thought of it as almost like a ritual. You know, classical music is the religion, and the repetition of these pieces over and over again is the ritual in this metaphor. But I really like that idea that there's actually something in the pieces themselves, in these composers, like something about that, rather than the music, the umbrella idea of the music itself.
Yes. I'm glad you understand it. It's not a bad analogy. It's not perfect, but I would I would also add that after you visit the room with all the Rubens and the other great works of art, you also want to visit the Contemporary Museum.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's no reason not to have both in your life, musically speaking.
Oh, yeah. This is great. This is so helpful.
Oh, good.
For my understanding of this. You know, Bach is one of those guys. And honestly, This is one of those questions that I kind of hate to ask, but I have to, because I know that, like, the wonderful thing about music is that you don't have to talk about it, that the music speaks for itself, and in fact, it speaks more than words does, and so I hate sort of dissecting it, you know, in this really discursive way, but, you know, Bach is one of those guys that people play over and over again, and if you could explain why, if you could explain what it is in his music that makes people come back to it, what is iconic, what is archetypal, I've got to figure out which word it is.
Yeah, I can try.
What is that about Bach?
Of all the composers that have written down their music on paper, at least to my spirit and understanding, the compositions of Bach stand on two extremely strong and focused pillars. The one is the universal expression, and the other is the completely subjective expression. Mm-hmm. So, but when I say universal, I mean there is a structure there. Every brick or stone is in its place and is balanced in the whole in such a way that each cell of the structure stands as a unity, and the whole thing is a unity. And that is extraordinary. This is something mm-hmm. that every human being yeah. can recognize. That's what I want to call the sixth sense of human beings. And it's the sense of balance, mm-hmm. of recognizing when something is balanced, and of recognizing that as mm-hmm. being universally good.
If I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, it's kind of like when you're listening to a piece of music, like sometimes it feels to me like that next note is inevitable. Like, of course that note is going to be there, because that's the note that was supposed to be there. But yeah. That doesn't make any sense, because a person wrote this, so nothing is supposed to be there. But, you know, that's kind of how I'm hearing what you're saying.
Yes, yes. There's a mathematical okay. balance. There's a structural balance. And then the other side is there's an emotional pillar, which is that mm. Bach probably of all composers had the strongest connection to being able to express human emotion in his music. Yeah. So we've got both things going simultaneously, yeah. not sequentially, but simultaneously. And so when you play Bach or listen to Bach, you are living on every possible level.
Wow. That doesn't happen with many things.
It does not happen with many things. You're right.
Visited the Classical Classroom website. It's at classicalclassroomshow.com, and I love it. It's downright useful and fun to look at. Not only can you find all of our past episodes there, you can also connect with us. You can download free lesson plans that go along with lots of our episodes, and by the way, new lesson plans are being added all the time. There's also a little button that says Tip Jar on our homepage. Yes, finally your dreams have come true, and you can leave us a one-time or recurring tip of anywhere from one to infinity dollars if you want to support the podcast. By the way, our friends at New Y made this amazing website, and they can make you a super cool website too. They can also help you promote it and your business. For more information about New Y, go to classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. And now back to my conversation with Kim Kashkashian. So we have to talk for a minute about the fact that, you know, you have made this album, The Six Suites, for viola solo. These were originally written for cello. So tell me about appropriating this music that Bach wrote for another instrument. Like, what was it like? What did you have to, tweak anything to bring it from cello to viola? And also, do you think Bach would be okay with this?
Okay. Last question first. Bach would be okay. Bach would be absolutely okay with it because he did it himself to his own music.
Really?
A lot. Yeah. He would write one thing and then change it to other instrumentations. So this is a practice that we know he approved of.
Okay. You had no qualms about just taking it and saying, okay, I'm going to do this on my own instrument.
Now. Okay, now, particularly not...
Give it a thumbs up.
Yeah, particularly not, Desha, okay. Here in this case, because the cello and the viola play these pieces in the same key. So G major stays G major.
Okay.
C minor stays C minor. It's just up an octave. The viola plays an octave higher, but nothing else gets changed. So you almost can't even call it a transcription because nothing gets changed except the fact that it's a higher voice. It's as if one sentence were being said by a person with a deep voice, a man with a very deep voice. And then the same sentence is said by a soprano with a high voice. It's the same sentence coming out of a different body.
Yeah.
So that's the relationship here of playing this music on the cello or the viola. It's a different body, same sentence.
So as a violist, because I'm learning about your world as a violist, are these pieces that you were playing when, you know, as a student learning the viola, were you playing this? Is this something new that you've done on this album, or is...
Okay.
Yeah, like, is this a thing that people typically do?
Okay. All violists start to learn these pieces as soon as they're past the intermediate stage, which means when they're 11, 12, 13 years old. So I've been playing, I hate to confess to this, but I've been playing this music for more than 50 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there's nothing new about it, and yet it's new every day. Because my understanding...
What makes it new?
My understanding grows and changes.
Okay.
And it's true for my students also. And all violists, my colleagues and students, everybody, we all play this music from our beginning developmental stages. And we live with it all our lives.
Do you feel like you play it better now, or that you just play it differently? What's changed for you over time? And like, what are people going to be hearing when they hear these recordings?
Whoa, you're asking some tough questions. In the first place...
I like to do that at the end of an interview.
We hope that when we change our ideas about a piece of music, that it's actually better. Certainly, it's a development. It's a process of development, which carries over decades. And when one decides to finally say, okay, I'm ready to record this, to put it down in such a form that in 10 years, people could also hear this particular performance, we are, in a sense, we're saying, okay, I still understand that in 5 months or 6 months, I'm going to think differently about this music than when I recorded it. I hope I will think differently about it. But it's at a point of maturity or development where I feel it's something I'm willing to communicate to the outside world.
Yeah.
It's very complicated to make a recording for that reason, because on the one hand, the musician needs to know that they're going to change, because otherwise they'd be dead, right? We're going to change.
Right.
And on the other hand, we need to be completely convinced that what we're doing at this given moment is something that will still stand in 10 years or maybe longer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have to have a lot of faith.
That is an interesting thing in pretty much in making anything, you know, in putting anything out into the world. You know, future you inevitably looks at past you in a different way than present you who's making the thing does. And, you know, you stand in judgment of yourself. But you're putting this thing out into the world for other people to hear. So it's this very kind of raw thing where you're allowing this present version of yourself to go out into the world, even though you know it's like it's not fully, it's maybe not as developed as it will be in the future.
Well, it's a moving target. And just, and I think, you know, a writer who finally says, okay, this is the book.
Yeah.
Everything else is in the trash can and this is the book. And still they have the chance, if they're still alive 10 years later, they can put out a second edition, they can revise.
Right.
And that's why some of us might re-record the same repertoire, to go back to one of your first questions, why do we repeat?
Yeah.
Right? Some people are recording these a particular kind of repertoire more than once in their performing lifetime. And maybe for that reason, it's like doing a revised version, or it's a new perspective, like turning the kaleidoscope, nah?
Yeah. Do you ever feel like you have reached a point where that's it, you've done it, you've said all that there is to say when you put a recording out? Or do you just get comfortable as a performer with the fact that time is always moving? And like you said, this thing, this feeling of having said what you need to say is a moving target.
Well, we prepare for recording with a great deal of focus. And ideally, we leave the recording saying, this is the very best that I can offer right now.
Yeah.
This is 150% of what I believe right now at this moment and can execute and show and want to share at this moment. And this moment is okay to document. But that requires a great deal of preparation. In the case of the Bach suites, years and years and years. And as I said, also just the faith that you can let go and say, okay, that is this moment and it's worth recording. And yes, of course, it's going to change.
Wow. Well, that is an amazing place to leave this conversation. Speaking of going ahead and releasing things into the world, saying they're okay. Kim Kashkashian, this has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much for teaching me about this today.
Thank you for talking with me, Daisha. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, that does it for this episode, but your fun doesn't have to stop there. No. For more Classroom, go to classicalclassroomshow.com, where you can find yet more Classical Classroom stuff, more than you can shake a stick at, whatever that means. As always, you can also go the old-fashioned route and email us at classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Thanks today to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM in Seattle, where it is definitely time to recycle that stack of unread New Yorkers. Thanks to our birthplace, Houston Public Media. Thanks to the official bagel supplier of Classical Classroom, Barney's Bagels. Ain't no bagel like a Barney's bagel, because a Barney's bagel don't stop. Just keeps going round and round. Thanks to Kim Kashkashian for being on the show. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.